of them a set of notes for lesson 151, establishing the pre-Jamesian historical context. So what we're going to be doing today is restarting our class, okay, that we've been at now for quite a long time. And I have a few things I want to say here by way of introduction to kind of get the ball rolling for this term. But if you're joining us on the internet right now, if you would go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, if you're on Facebook, and you're going to want to click on the link here for September 22nd, and you'll see lesson 151 there, and then you can click and pull up a digital copy of the notes so that you can follow along with what we're doing here in the classroom. And then if you're on YouTube, there's a link in the description under this video. It's already there right now for you to access, okay? So let's get started here and get rolling, and things will sort of just develop as we get started. So introduction, page one, introduction. The last time we had class on Sunday, May 30th, we concluded our study of the pre-King James English Bibles by wrapping up our discussion of the Reims New Testament in lesson 150. So that was, seems like a long time ago now, especially with the added time now that we've had the last number of weeks. But that's where we were. Remember, we went all the way from the Wycliffe Bible. We actually started with the Anglo-Saxon Gospels and the Wycliffe Bible, and we went all the way through to the Reims New Testament from 1583, I believe, if my memory is correct, on the year. And so we looked at Tyndale. We looked at all those Bibles. We studied them in sequence and in progression, and we looked at a lot of things related to the history of the English Bible before the King James Bible. Okay, so if you're joining us right now with lesson 151, or if you're watching for the first time, you're definitely going to want to go back and try to get that information. Now, it's not essential. You know, I'm sure that the people sitting here, if I gave them the test, probably wouldn't pass it. Maybe, I don't know. But there is not going to be a test. I should do that sometime just to satisfy my curiosity. But anyway, there's a lot of material, in other words, that we've gone through. Okay, we spent a whole year talking about the doctrine of inspiration. We spent a whole year talking about the doctrine of preservation. We spent a whole year talking about the issue of canonicity and transmission. And then we got into issues related to translation. Okay, so it's been, we've been at this for a while now, and we're in lesson 151 now. So, look at the next point. After 150 lessons covering inspiration, preservation, canonicity, transmission, and translation, we are now ready to begin discussing the King James Bible specifically. Okay? So, as you know, my goal has been to be as thorough and comprehensive as my time and resources would allow, and I make no apologies for having devoted more than 150 hours of study on these topics, despite criticism from some quarters that I am simply trying to be academic and thereby complicate the, quote, simplicity that is in Christ when it comes to the King James Bible, okay? So let me just be safe. Not everyone has appreciated what we've tried to do here, okay? I've been accused in some quarters of just trying to be academic, just trying to show off, just trying to make things more difficult than they need to be and not just deal with the simplicity of the issue, okay? And I understand why some people feel that way, but I'm not, I think that what we've done and what we've put together here is a collection of information that is long overdue as far as the, an accurate understanding of these issues, okay? Many of the other things I've seen, while in and of themselves, they're not bad. It's not like they're saying bad things, although some things I think are not accurate in what has been said. They're not as in depth, I feel, as they need to be to really get to the bottom and really understand what is going on with these doctrines and this issue. Look at the next point. Unfortunately, as has been demonstrated throughout this class, King James advocates have often used inaccurate information to advance their position. As I stated in my book, The King James Bible in America, quote, I believe that it is detrimental to the integrity of the position, the pro-King James position, to say things that cannot be supported by the historical and or textual facts. The truth does not benefit from rhetoric, no matter how well intended, that can easily be proven wrong by a better command of the relevant facts. King James Bible believers have enough challenges as it is without adopting positions that expose our flanks to further attack. Much that has been written in pro-King James literature in defense of the position possesses a superficial appeal, but is nonetheless incorrect. As King James Bible believers, we need to make sure that we are applying the Berean principle, Acts 17:11, to our position on the Bible, and search things out to make sure that they are so. Empty, unsound, and incorrect rhetoric does not help our position, it harms it. Therefore, is it incumbent upon believers who stand for the infallibility of the King James Bible to enunciate a position which is accurate and in accordance with the historical and textual facts. And that's a quote from my book there from pages 131 through 135. Okay? So, I've said it all along. You guys that have been here, you know that I've made a point to say that there are things about this topic that have been said that are just simply not true, that are factually wrong and are easily demonstrated to be wrong by looking at the data, by looking at the facts that can be mined out and presented both textually and historically. Historically, the King James position has been championed most visibly and vocally by Acts 2 Baptists who vehemently oppose mid-Acts Pauline dispensationalism. So I have a whole shelf at home, basically from my ceiling almost all the way to my floor, of just books that have been written about this issue. Okay, pro-King James books written by pro-King James authors. They are almost all of them written by Acts 2 Baptists who do not agree with our dispensational position that the church, the body of Christ, started with the salvation and conversion and commissioning of Saul of Tarsus, of Paul, the Apostle Paul, on the road to Damascus, okay? So much of the literature that's out there has been written from a dispensational viewpoint and from a theological standpoint that is not in agreement with where we are at on those same issues. Consequently, much has been said in pro-King James literature that is not only inconsistent with Pauline dispensationalism, but it is also detrimental to an accurate enunciation of the pro-King James position in general. Therefore, one of my goals for this class, from its inception, was to present the pro-King James position in a manner that was devoid of obvious factual errors and questionable rhetoric. Okay? Top page 2. If asked, I would be hard-pressed to think of even one book on the King James position, except the one I wrote, of course, but we're digressing. That I would be hard-pressed to think of even one book on the King James position that I could recommend to somebody without reservation or equivocation. The available literature on the matter is full of doctrinal problems of a dispensational nature, documentation problems, factual errors, plagiarism, ad hominem attacks, and tabloid-style sensationalism. Okay? So, of that shelf I have, basically from my ceiling to my floor, of nothing but books on this topic, there's not hardly any of them that I could recommend to somebody and say, here, I could fully endorse everything that's said in this book for the variety of reasons that I identified there on the top of page 2. Over the past decade, since the King James conferences in 2011, so stop right there. In 2011, there was a series of conferences hosted all around the United States to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. Okay, so the King James Bible was published in 1611. So in 2011, there was a lot said at Bible conferences and even culturally in books written and so on and so forth talking about that sort of milestone event. And so over the past decade, since the King James conferences of 2011, I have become convinced that mid-Acts Pauline dispensationalists need to chart our own course with respect to the Bible issue by doing our own research and creating our own literature and resources. Therefore, this class and some of the books and stuff that I've written and put out there, okay? Because I believe that we have allowed, when I say we, I mean mid-Acts dispensationalists, we have allowed people who we do not agree with theologically to lead the way on this issue in a way that we would never allow on any other issue. So, next point. It is my belief that the King James Bible was the result of a nearly 100-year process of refinement that began with William Tyndale in 1526. Tyndale's rough draft was further refined through the publication of the following English translations of the TR, or the Textus Receptus: Coverdale's in 1535, Matthew's Bible from 1538, the Great Bible from 1539, the Geneva Bible 1560, the Bishop's and the Bishop's Bible from 1568, as well as the Rheims New Testament from 1582. Okay? So that's where we left off with lesson 150, is concluding our conversation about the Rheims. So we talked about all of those Bibles and how there's a Tyndalean line going all the way through, okay, that eventually produces the King James. So one of the goals of this term will be to investigate the historical context in which the decision to retranslate was made in 1604. What was the decision, the result of divine supernatural intervention whereby God pulled the strings of King James to authorize a new translation, or was there already a movement within the Bible-believing, English-speaking world before 1604 that saw the need for a new translation? I believe that the historical evidence speaks to the truthfulness of the latter as opposed to the former. If the doctrine of preservation is valid, we should see it conforming itself in history. In other words, if what we believe about preservation is true, should we be able to go out in history and see it happen that way? Okay? Which we've already studied a lot about in past lessons. Where am I? Furthermore, the latter view is consistent with the mid-acts dispensational position regarding God's working in time, i.e. God works through believers as they believe and apply God's word to the details of their lives. A second goal revolves around utilizing primary sources from the early 17th century to inform our understanding of the translation process and the textual choices of the translators. Consequently, we will be endeavoring to look behind the translation process and demystify it to some degree. So what I mean there is the following. People have said a lot of stuff about the process and about how the translation was done and how they went about it without a working knowledge of the primary documents that exist that we can look at and see what they were doing at different stages of the process in real time. Okay? So there's a lot of stuff that has been said in a lot of this literature, in a lot of this teaching, that is not necessarily accurate when it comes to that. Next point. Thirdly, we will endeavor to ascertain the printed history of the text, its reception by early 17th century Englishmen, as well as its impact upon the English-speaking world. The course that I have charted for this term will be difficult, sometimes maybe frustrating, enlightening, and time-consuming. This is a story that must be told to shine the light of understanding onto the men and process that gave us our English Bible. Okay? So I'll stop there, see if anybody has any questions before we talk about the first major point. So all that was introduction. Does anybody have any questions or comments about that before we move on to point two?
Was this translation the first English version that people could actually read, as opposed to like a Latin version?
No.
If it was even available.
No. Middle English people could read Wycliffe's Middle English translation, and English people could read Tyndale's New Testament starting in 1526. In fact, one of Tyndale's main goals was to put the Bible into the language of the plowboy so that the common man could read the Bible and understand what they were reading. So, no, this is not the first Bible that an English person could read. There were definitely precursors. And before that, in the late 900s, around the year 1000, somewhere in there, there was the West Saxon or the Anglo-Saxon Gospels that were translated into Anglo-Saxon. But that wasn't a whole Bible. That was just the Gospels. Okay? But, and again, Bart, if you are interested in that, I covered all of that stuff in previous lessons. If you are interested, I can direct you to where you can find that information. Any other questions before we go on? Okay, so what I want to talk today primarily about is what I'm calling the pre-Jamesian context. Okay? How many of you have ever heard the term Jacobin? You've heard that term? Somebody talk about the Jacobin era. You ever heard that? Okay. Jacobin is a term that is used to describe the era of James's reign. Okay. So when you hear the term Jacobin, they're talking about the era and the time frame in which James was the king of England. So starting in 1603 and then until his death in like 1622 or something like that, that's the time period referred to as Jacobin. Okay? Now, what I want to talk about is before that, the pre-Jamesian historical context. So when James becomes king of England, when Elizabeth dies in 1603 and James becomes king of England, what I'm after is, what is the situation, what does the landscape look like, the political and religious landscape look like in England when James becomes king? Okay? Because what we need to understand with the King James Bible is that a lot of what happens with respect to it is a sort of divergence between the time period and the era before James and the mindset and beliefs of James himself. So that's what we're going to look at next week. Next week we'll look at James and who James was and what James's thoughts were politically and religiously. And we got to understand the context James inherits and then understand some things about James to really get to the bottom of and have a clear understanding about why James is going to agree to sanction a new translation of the Bible. Okay? So we have some work we need to do before we get to that point. So let's start at the bottom of page 2. Talking about the pre-Jamesian historical context, okay? So during the 29 years, is that right? Yeah, 29 years from the publication of the Rheims New Testament in 1582 to the publication of the King James in 1611, this would be the latter years of the reign of Queen Elizabeth and the early years of King James, the English achieved some of the culture's most glorious exploits, okay? While this is not the main focus of our study, we would be remiss to not note the following from the pen of Charles C. Butterworth in this transformative. I want to change that to regarding this transformative time period. So if you can make a note of that, Sylvia, let's change into regarding this transformative time period. So let's look at the quote here from Butterworth. He says, quote, during these years, okay, so what years are we talking about? Those would be the years from 1582 to 1611. The tail end of Elizabeth's reign and the beginning of James's reign in England, okay? During these years, England achieved some of its most glorious exploits, the record of which still imparts a glow to what has been called the spacious days of Queen Elizabeth. Though the recounting of these triumphs is not vital to our subject, they make a lively background for the period of which we speak. Sir Francis Drake defeated the Spanish Armada, thus making England a political power. And Shakespeare, the most prominent figure of the English Renaissance, and Sir Walter Raleigh played a leading part in the English colonization of North America, and Lord Bacon, an English philosopher and statesman who served as the Attorney General and Lord Chancellor of England, his works are seen as being seen as developing the scientific method and remain influential throughout the scientific revolution. May take no part in our, that should say, particular chronicle, but they were all upon the stage. Okay, so you need to understand that historically, culturally, politically, during the tail end of the reign of Elizabeth and the beginning of the reign of James, some very significant things are happening, okay? The English become a world power by defeating the Spanish Armada under Sir Francis Drake and Queen Elizabeth, okay? Shakespeare starts writing his plays during the tail end of Elizabeth and the beginning of James. Shakespeare is by far and away the leading figure of the English Renaissance, okay? And culturally and linguistically, obviously, probably one of the, outside of the King James Bible itself, the most significant figure, okay? At the same time, Sir Walter Raleigh is instrumental in what would be the experiment at Roanoke Island and the first English colony in the New World. That one didn't work out, but it paved the way for later the colony of Jamestown, right? Named after who? King James, to be founded in what is present-day Virginia. So during the tail end of Elizabeth and the beginning of James's reign, there's a lot of significant things that are happening as far as the history of the English people is concerned. It was also during these years, look at the next point, that the Jamestown colony, the first permanent English settlement in North America, was established in 1607. Needless to say, the later years of Elizabeth's reign saw England emerge as a world power and cultural leader. James would project that power across the Atlantic and began the process of colonizing what would eventually become the United States. While these points are interesting and deserving of further study, they are not our focus. We are primarily concerned with the religious context of the age and the influence it exerted upon the English Bible. So there's a ton of interesting stuff that you can study there. I'd love to do that and spend time on that, but that's not really what we're here for. Okay, so I'm going to leave all that stuff. I just present it to you as background. Okay, so please recall from lesson 138, the Bishop's Bible, understanding the Elizabethan context, that we reviewed the political and religious context that gave rise to the Bishop's Bible in 1568. Remember that Queen Elizabeth ascended the English throne in 1558 following the death of her half-sister, Mary I, in November 1558. Mary's death signaled that it was safe for English exiles to return home from their places of continental refuge. Recall that a group stayed behind in Geneva, Switzerland to finish the complete Geneva Bible that was published in 1560. So just briefly, right? Mary comes to the throne, Mary I, and she wants to move England back under the authority of who? The Pope, the Catholic Church, right? So Mary is going to persecute Protestants in England, which is going to lead to a mass migration of English people out of England onto the continent of Europe. Many of them went to Luther's Germany, and a bunch of them went to Calvin's Geneva in Switzerland, where they took refuge. During that time, a group of English scholars, translated the Geneva Bible. Okay, now we've studied all about that in the past. Blackford Condon, author of The History of the English Bible, has an excellent section discussing this historical context. Now, I quoted this before, back in lesson 138, since I know you all remember what I said, we just won't read it right now. Just kidding, we're going to read it. Bottom of page 3. The reign of Queen Elizabeth was a transitional period. In ecclesiastical affairs, nothing was settled. The short reign of Edward VI gave an impetus to Protestant principles which bade fair to decide the question of supremacy between the old and new learning. So that's between, you know, Renaissance and stuff related to the Reformation. A serious check, however, was given to this progress by the short but fierce reign of Queen Mary. But now the friends of the Reformation looked upon the ascension of Elizabeth with joy and heartfelt relief. Protestantism, just returned from exile, is stronger in its convictions and broader in its designs. Abroad, it came into contact with men and ideas by such contact gained in respect, while at home it had been tried in the fire and thereby purified and made stronger. So let me just make one brief comment. These English exiles that flee Mary, Bloody Mary's reign, and come to the continent, do they rub shoulders in Geneva, Switzerland, and in Luther's Germany with the absolute leading academic and theological lights of the Reformation movement? Luther and Melanchthon in Germany, and Beza and Calvin and a bunch of other, and probably Stephanus to some degree in Switzerland, right? And so when they come back now from this period of exile after the death of Mary or Bloody Mary, there's a renewed sort of vigor about what they want to do and what they want to accomplish. And they view Elizabeth as the perfect person now for them to accomplish religiously what they want to accomplish, okay? So let's continue on page 4 with the quote from Condon. At first, the reformers were overconfident in the respect that the friendship of Elizabeth, now I have an insertion here, the Epistle Dedicatory of the 1560 Geneva Bible is a clear example, in my opinion, of this overconfidence. Remember, there's they dedicated to the Queen, and excuse my language, but for lack of a better term, they kind of kiss her butt a little bit and want her to kind of approve this thing. You know, that's kind of what they're doing. Okay, they attempt radical changes, such as quote to set up King Edward's service, to put down images and to affront the priests. So, in other words, do these reformers want further radical, do they think the English Reformation has gone far enough?
No.
They want more what? More change, and they think Elizabeth is going to be in favor of this at first. But in this, they met with an effectual check from the Queen, who, though slow in developing her policy, soon made it evident that not even the English Church, much less the Genevan Party, had anything to expect from her by way of partial favors. Passing between the extremes of Edward and Mary, she followed the ecclesiastical policy of her royal father, thinking by a middle course to reconcile opposing parties. She insisted, however, that there should be no persecution for opinion's sake, that the consciences of all should be respected. The two great ideals of Queen Elizabeth were order in the state and uniformity in the church. And the latter, contrary to her boasted respect for the individual's conscience, was to be enforced for the sake of the former. So in other words, at the end of the day, what does she care more about? Political situation or the religious situation? She cares more about the political situation, right? So what she's going to do is she's going to try to walk a middle line, a middle way, between Edward, her half-brother, and Bloody Mary. So she's going to allow people generally the freedom to believe what they want, but as far as official policy goes, she's not going to make too many changes so she's never going to make anybody really happy with her on this front, okay? The high churchmen are going to be mad at her because she's allowed too much reform, and the Puritans are going to be mad at her because she hasn't allowed what? Enough reform, all right? Everybody with that? During the reign of Henry VIII, the church was made the child of the state, and political considerations ruled in ecclesiastical affairs. So, under Elizabeth, though she refused spiritual supremacy in the form of title, yet held the bishops indeed subject to her royal will, she berated them to their faces, and in writing to them threatened to unfrock them if they did not comply with her requests. Dead to religious conviction, serious controversies in religion had no interest to her. The Reformation in England might have been thorough and evangelical had it not been for Queen Elizabeth. There was, on the part of the leaders of the evangelical party, the requisite spirituality, learning, and ability to have accomplished a grand work, especially since the people, weary of the Marian persecution, were so prepared for it. But Elizabeth ignored the power of the gospel, and having a decided distaste to Puritan simplicity, determined to hold to a part at least of the pomp and magnificence of the Romanist church. Her opinion was that images were not contrary to the Word of God, and the use of them in churches might be a means to stir up devotion, and that at least it would draw all people to frequent them more, for the great measure of her counsels was to unite the whole nation unto one way of religion. And for the sake of established order, she determined upon a compromise in things indifferent, to which both Papists and Protestants must submit. Elizabeth held to the vain hope that the time would come when Catholic and Anglican could come together on some moderate common ground. But this forced unity only begat diversity, and this constrained order only brought forth discord. So that from the beginning, the establishment of Elizabeth pleased neither of the parties. To the ultra-Protestants, it was no better than the Romanish. To the Catholics, or partial Catholics, it was a schism from the communion of Christendom, while the great middle party, the common sense of the country, of whom Elizabeth was the representative, was uneasy and dissatisfied. So, does everybody understand what's going on here? All right? Elizabeth comes to power and she has a choice. And what she decides is, I'm going to walk the middle road. Okay? Now, this is somewhat negative about Elizabeth here, right? Let me just say, all this being said, Elizabeth never did anything to restrict the people's access from the Bible. Okay? She never did that. She never tried to restrict access to the Bible or say only certain people could read the Bible, but she did not adopt the wide sweeping reforms that the Protestants that the Puritans wanted. And so as a result, the thing was kind of stuck in this middle ground between not wholly Catholic, but also for some, not Protestant enough. Is everybody following that? Any questions about that before we move on?
What was the hold that the Catholic Church had on countries at that time? Did they actually control government?
Oh, yeah.
Influence it? Or
oh, no.
Were they getting tribute from the countries that they were in?
The Catholic Church, we talked about this in the Grace History Project, the Catholic Church absolutely exerted authority and extracted money and power and all sorts of things from the kings of Europe before the Reformation.
When England separated more?
Well, when England separates from them, England is its own entity, and the church was always trying to bring England back under their dominion.
Right.
Okay, but they never, and they succeeded for a time with Mary, but then Mary died and Elizabeth was put in, and so they never fully ever went back under the dominion of the church. And by the church, I mean the Catholic Church, obviously. So, bottom of page 4. Ecclesiastical partyism was rife in the time of Elizabeth. The Catholics, under Ban, experienced a secret but powerful revival. Priests disguised in, quote, serving men's apparel, swarmed the north. And in other parts of England, though not permitted to preach, they administered mass in private chapels and reopened the iniquities of the spiritual courts. They maintained the Pope's authority and revived the ancient usages of commuting penance for money, compounding the moral enormities,
yeah,
and grinding the widow and the orphan by fees and extortions. While popery thus revived, maintained its unity, Protestantism was divided and yet strong, notwithstanding its divisions. Nonconformists grew vigorous by conflict. The Puritan was a sturdy defender of his bold and radical principles, and had it not been for his deep convictions and fierce energy, the English Church Party would have been swallowed up by Catholic fanaticism. So, in other words, if it weren't for these Puritans being so dogmatically opposed to the Catholic system, what Condon is saying is that the Catholic system might have swallowed the thing back up. But that's not what happened, okay? In the meantime, the Presbyterians became a distinct party, particularly in Scotland, which is important for us because James was king of Scotland for 20 plus years nearly before he also became king of what? England, okay? So in the meantime, the Presbyterians became a distinct party, setting up a new ecclesiastical polity with its corresponding discipline. They became, as it were, a wheel within a wheel, all of which gave no little offense to the state establishment. So that's a summary of the situation religiously and politically during the reign of Elizabeth. Okay? Now, next Sunday we'll talk about James. And we'll be able to then make some comparisons between James and his upbringing with what was going on in England here under Elizabeth. Okay? Now, look at the next point. Timothy Berg, author of the blog King James Bible History, also shed some interesting light on the pre-Jamesian religious historical context in his post titled The Coming of King James and the Millenary Petition. Now, before we go any further here, this is the website I'm referring to, okay? This has a lot of very good, well-researched articles on here, and I am going to be using this website as a reference. I've spoken to Brother Berg about that, and he said that, you know, I was free to do that, and of course I'm giving him credit here in the notes and so forth for his work. But he's done some work here on the coming of King James and the Millenary Petition. So if you scroll down, you can see the article. The actual article that I'm referring to is this one right here. I'm not going to call it up right now. You can look at it later. We're going to quote from it here as we move to the next point. So this is what Timothy Berg says. He says, quote, "After decades of jolting back and forth under Henry's changing whims, Edward's passionate and speedy program of reform, and in Mary I's violent reversal of it, the only constant in English religion for the last three decades had been change." Had been change. Now with the ED at the end. When Mary died and her sister Elizabeth took the throne in 1558, Protestant reform began again, but of a quite different nature. Elizabeth, at the start of her reign, froze all the movement with what has come to be called the Elizabethan Statement. Okay? Settlement, excuse me. So, when these notes go live, I'll just show you here, because what page are we on? 5? So this is a digital copy of the notes. Here's where we're at, Elizabethan Statement. If you click that, settlement. Why do I keep saying that? Of course, it won't work now. But anyway, that'll be a link to take you to read the Elizabethan Settlement. Okay. So notice how Berg says that. He says it froze it in what? In time, right? So what Elizabeth is doing is, and I like the way he describes that. It's almost like her policies are like freezing the religious and political situation in that middle way between the extremes of Edward and Mary. Let's look at the next paragraph. The settlement essentially consisted of two acts of Parliament. The first was the Act of Supremacy, which established the Queen as, quote, "the only supreme governor of this realm, and all Her Highness's dominions and countries, as well as all spiritual and ecclesiastical things or causes as temporal." Is she an absolute ruler? Yep. "This granted the monarch absolute power over the church, restoring the Edwardian system that had been revoked under Mary. Though Elizabeth wisely self-styled herself, quote, governor, rather than head, as her father had done, perhaps sensitive to hesitation about a monarch as head of the church and a woman at that, a title reserved for Christ in the Bible." That's his speculation. I don't know if that's true. "Second was the Act of Uniformity, which established a newly amended 1559 Book of Common Prayer as the required liturgy of rites and ceremonies in the Church of England, a drastic change from the Catholic reign of her sister, Bloody Mary, but not quite the rapidly reforming reign of her brother, Edward VI. Coming with all this was the establishment of the new Articles of Religion, amending the older Articles, the closest thing that the Church of England would ever have to a consistent doctrinal statement." So, here we see the Elizabethan settlement is a result of these two acts. The Acts of Supremacy, which make her the head of what? The Church of England. And then the Act of Uniformity, which changes the Book of Common Prayer and sets the liturgy and so forth of the Anglican Church. Is everybody following this? Okay? In the 1559 Book of Common Prayer, the 1559 Book of Common Prayer became both emblematic of Elizabeth's religious policy and a lightning rod for those desiring further reform. Top of page 6, quote, "What was so radical or confusing about the new prayer book was, first, that it was decidedly Protestant." So that's a win for the Protestants, okay? It's decidedly Protestant, starkly revising Mary's Catholic Church, but second, that it was frozen in place. Rather than simply reinstate the 1552 book that had finally been moving reform forward at a faster pace, or take the opportunity of the new liberty to press forward with further reform, Elizabeth's book took the 1552 book as a base and froze it in time. So does everybody understand what's going on there? Okay? The book of her half-brother, Edward, was done in 1552. He dies, Mary takes over, and then she reigns for a while, etc. But then what happens is Elizabeth, in 1559, she's going to, in the new Book of Common Prayer, it's decidedly more Protestant. But what it is, essentially does is it freezes the reform at where things stood when? In 1552, and so it's not going to carry the reform any further than that.
How long did Bloody Mary reign then?
Four or five years, something like that.
Okay. I didn't realize it was so short.
It wasn't terribly long. It was terribly destructive if you were a Protestant. She burned over 300 Protestants at the stake, which is why so many of them left. But anyway, does everybody understand what I'm saying here? Okay, so let's go back to the notes.
Where did the prayer books come from?
The prayer books came from the bishops and so forth of the Anglican Church working in conjunction with the monarch to get them approved. So the prayer books would have had the liturgy, they would have had the official church calendar and all that sort of stuff in them, as well as extracts from the Bible that they were following in the liturgy. Now, have any of you ever grown up in a liturgical church? So for a while when I was growing up, I went to a Lutheran school. And seasonally, they would literally change all the vestments, the colors, and everything in the church were all changed to the current liturgical season. Okay? And then the pastors of the Lutheran church would follow the Lutheran church liturgy. It's really kind of not a great situation, but that's what was happening. Okay? The Anglican church is very much still sort of a high church. I mean, you come into this church building and like, is there anything in here necessarily smacking of religion? No, I mean, I'm not even wearing a tie these days, right? I mean, it's just so relaxed in here. I mean, you might as well be at Starbucks, right? What I'm saying is, in high churches, they are all about this liturgy. Okay? And the Puritans wanted to go what? They wanted to go further. But what Elizabeth does through these acts that we just talked about is she freezes this thing in time, basically reinstating what? What her half-brother did earlier. Okay? Let's go back to the notes. What sentence are we on?
Rather than simply reinstate.
Are we on the top? Okay, rather than simply reinstate the 1552 book that had been finally been moving reform forward at a faster pace, or take the opportunity of the new liberty to press forward with further reform, Elizabeth's book took the 1552 as a base and froze it in time. Indeed, it even sent a glance backwards toward the 1549 prayer book that had only been intended as a stopgap. The crystal clear, quote, black rubric was removed, and a reference to the real presence, to the real presence was restored. There was still a heavy dose of the ceremonialism that reformers had been intended to abolish as popish. Is everybody following that? Okay? So, these decisions, I'm just going to go through this last bit and we'll take questions at the end. These decisions by Queen Elizabeth created a breeding ground of religious controversy that served as the backdrop for James's ascension to the throne in 1604. Quote, again from Berg. I think Berg's doing an excellent job here with this material. Quote, ceremony and how much of it, if any, there should be, became the new battleground of the controversy in the church. The Elizabethan Church was the only Reformed Church in the world to still have an elaborate episcopacy of bishops over priests and deacons, retaining the medieval threefold order. So, the Lutherans got rid of that, the Reformed under Calvin got rid of that, but the Anglican Church did what? They kept all that stuff, okay? These bishops still had a throne in their massive and elaborate cathedrals. There was still a sharply ceremonial liturgical year, and there was still heavy ritual surrounding the daily life and occasional services of the church. Its ministers still wore reduced but still present clerical vestments, special clothing for officiants at liturgical services of sorts, a stark reminder of the medieval church. The act of uniformity imposed severe penalties for ministers failing to subscribe to the Book of Common Prayer and the Articles of Faith, and required the clergy to wear vestments of the second year of Edward's reign, whatever that might have meant. I don't even know what that means. Clerical vestments were a sore point among Puritans for some time in the church, especially in the Vestrian controversy. Questions of what should be worn, when, and by whom reasserted themselves controversially for years to come. The issue at hand wasn't so much about clothing as about its continuing use, and the monarchy's claiming of the prerogative to regulate it could be argued to represent. Clerical dress, McAuliffe explains, quote, might seem trivial until one realizes the symbolism involved. Separate dress for the clergy in both worship and everyday life implied a continuing doctrine of a separately ordained priestly order within the Reformed congregation of God's people, a notion which casts uncomfortable religious spotlights over the other, more profound imperfections of the Elizabethan Reformation, right? So, how many of you been to the hospital, and you go in there, and it says clergy parking? And they're like the best spots in the, you know, besides the handicap spots, they're like the best spots in the whole parking deck, right? What's that about? That's about the idea that there's somehow something what?
Special
about being clergy. Okay? So the dress issue was not so much about the particular, we need this vestment or that smock over this smock, or we don't like the color. It was more doing that created a clergy-laity division within the church, right? And one of the tenets of the reformers was what they called the priesthood of all believers, and that you did not need to go through a clergy member, but as a believer, you could go straight to who? God Himself through Jesus Christ, okay, as far as prayer and all that sort of thing, okay? So the settlement thus granted a uniform structure to the Church of England's worship, a uniformity that remained highly controversial throughout Elizabeth's reign, and that effectively stalled the violent roller coaster of change that had afflicted England for three decades. But for most, it was halting what should have kept moving. The 1552 prayer book was only meant to be one more step, and the new prayer book should have been a further step, with yet more steps to come. Reformation, Peter Marshall notes, was a journey, a continual striving after elusive perfection in the world and in oneself. Thus, for some, the latest measures of 1559 were a staging post, not a final destination. But the Reformation, Queen Elizabeth believed, was over. In some minds, reform had stalled out, just as it was free to reach the bottom of the hill, and those who could see their goal through the windshield were frustrated that Elizabeth seemed to have hit the brakes. Indeed, she could be said to have thrown the car into park, and to have demanded not one get out and walk anywhere. In the last decades before James took the throne, discontent quieted down. Not because it had gone away, but because it was clear that Elizabeth was not going to allow any further change in her church. Some complained was still, quote, but halfway reformed, and which, it must be acknowledged, still, quote, remain haunted by its Catholic past. So, thus, there were many who saw the death of Elizabeth, and this is the thing. These people that were basically shut down under Queen Elizabeth, most notably the Puritans, when Elizabeth dies and James is now going to take the throne, do they see here an opportunity now to try to get the kind of reforms that they've been wanting for decades under Elizabeth? Okay? So thus there were many who saw in the death of Elizabeth an opportunity to advance their religious cause. with the soon-to-be-coronated James. We will continue to explore these issues as a means of understanding the backdrop for the King James Bible in the next lesson. Folks, I firmly believe, especially as a history teacher and a historian, that if we're going to really understand what was going on in 1604 with James's decision to authorize a new translation, you cannot fully understand that without understanding this context. Okay? So, James, who's already been king of Scotland now for at least a decade and a half, is now going to travel south, out of Scotland into England, and he's met in the way by a bunch of Puritans with a document called the Millenary Petition, asking the king to do what? Reform the church. To continue the process of reforming the church. Okay? So, there's a lot going on here, and the decision to translate the King James Bible does not happen in a vacuum. Wholly unrelated to other things that are going on. Okay? So we've got a few minutes. Anybody have any questions? I'm done with the notes a little bit early. Anybody have any questions or anything you want to ask about pertaining to what we covered this morning?
When was the 100 years war?
I should know this because I did my master's thesis on it. No, I did my master's thesis on the 30 years war. The 100 years war was between France and England.
Okay.
And that was before this, if my memory is right.
Did that have nothing to do with Catholics against Protestants?
That had more to do with England against France than religious stuff.
Okay.
Somebody look up, are you looking up the dates?
Yeah.
What about the War of the Roses?
That War of the Roses is the English Civil War.
Did that have to do with religion?
Yeah, it had to do with religion because the Puritans under Cromwell took control of the English government and cut the king's head off. That's coming later.
Okay.
But yeah.
1337.
Yeah. So that was before. One of the reasons the Hundred Years' War took 100 years is because it was interrupted by the Black Death. And so they took all the time out for however long the Black Death took, and then they started fighting each other again. So, but no, the Hundred Years' War is something different.
And weren't wars back then kind of seasonal? They'd fight for a time and then go back and farm or whatever needed to.
Well, I mean, wars were definitely more seasonal than they are now. But under the feudal system, these kings and nobles and lords, they had knights, which were like professional soldiers of the day.
Right.
And then you had other infantrymen who probably were somewhat seasonal, but even some of them eventually were more like mercenaries in that they were getting paid by the lord to be a part of the army.
Yeah.
But that's all sort of a little bit more convoluted.
I mean, it's almost like I remember the Revolutionary War being, they were kind of volunteers, but they had to go back and feed their families and get supplies and different things.
Well, even in that war, you had the regular army, and then you had the militia.
Yep.
And there was always tension between the militias and the regular army over those kinds of things.
Yep.
So the militias would want to be seasonally dismissed to go tend to their farm or whatever, and that's could be highly inconvenient depending on what's going on with the war.
Oh, sure.
But to your questions, the War of the Roses is the English Civil War. That happens in the middle of the 1600s. But it is religiously motivated highly, for sure. Anybody else with a question?
Prayer book that still exists today.
Yeah.
The Anglican
Church still follows a prayer book of some. I don't know all the details about it now or what it looks like, but yes, they definitely still follow the liturgy.
Has it changed a whole lot?
I'm sure it's changed. I can't say how much it's changed in near over 400 years. But this church down the road from us, this Episcopal church, the one down here with the statue of Jesus standing there like this, that just down the road a few blocks.
Mm-hmm.
Episcopal is basically Anglican too. If I'm not mistaken, if you drive by the church sign, you'll see a flag or a crest or a shield on that sign, and I'm pretty sure that that's a Anglican-type church. Now, there aren't a lot of them around here, but there are definitely still some. So if you want to, you know, go take a field trip, just don't do it on a Sunday morning.
I think there's one in Allendale. It says, we're former Roman Catholics. And
okay.
I used to live in Allendale, and it says the only Catholic church, but it says it's not a Roman Catholic church.
Right. That's why that one says a similar thing.
Anglican Catholic Church.
Anglican. Yep. That's what it is.
Yep.
It's an Anglican church.
Church of England.
Yep. So then you can think through all of what that means, right? So then when these Englishmen come over here to the New World, what you start seeing in the colonies is very clear denominational divisions being set up in the English colonies. So all of that starts with what we're talking about here.
Maryland, Baltimore, that was more Catholic.
Maryland was the only Catholic colony of the original 13. Okay? And then, like, you know, Rhode Island was Baptist, and, you know, it's the same thing in the South, in Georgia and other spots. They were very, and of course, Massachusetts and New England was Puritan. You know, Calvinist Puritan all the way. So you start seeing those kinds of things happen as time goes on. But for what we talked about today, we got to get this sort of political religious background, because what's happening then is you've got different factions that are coming. And in fact,
the Anglican faction, so you also need to understand that you've got, at this point, you've got two primary Bibles. The Anglican faction is going to favor the Bishop's Bible,
because it was translated by Anglican bishops.
Okay? Meanwhile, the Puritan faction is going to favor which Bible? The Geneva Bible. So when James becomes king, he's inheriting a situation where England is extremely religiously divided. Peace has been maintained because of the Elizabethan reign. And both of these groups are going to be worried about what's going to happen to their power and their situation as the new king assumes the throne. Okay, so I want to say anything more about that now, because
you have to come back next time. All right, if there's no other questions, we'll shut this down and pack it up. If you have something you want to talk about, we can...